Now, the comedian Arthur Smith scours the archives for the best and worst after-dinner speeches in history to bring us his guide to making the perfect after-dinner speech. With no referring to notes and no heckling, ladies and gentlemen, please raise your glasses.
And without further ado, let me introduce you a gentleman that needs no introduction. His name is Arthur Smith, comedian and grumpy old man himself. Over to Arthur.
Thank you very much, David. Welcome, everybody. Well, it's a beautiful, warm summer night. You are the most glamorous people in Britain. And it is the Charity Retail Award Ceremony. I am Arthur Smith, unless there's anybody here from Streatham Tax Office, in which case I'm Daphne Fairfax.
Tony Benn says sincerity is the key. Sir John Harvey Jones maintains it should last no longer than 12 minutes. Above all, stay sober, says Sir Ian McCaskill. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the after-dinner speech.
Modern man, by some malignant fate, when he's eaten, simply must orate.
A baby's brain starts to function the minute it's born, and it only ceases to function the minute it gets up to speak.
My lords, ladies and gentlemen, Dukes of Edinburgh and the Duke Egg of Duchess of Edinburgh, if she's here.
A speech should never be like a Rolls Royce. It shouldn't be well oiled. It shouldn't go on forever. It shouldn't be inaudible.
You want to be entertaining, don't dwell on the subject any second longer than you look as if the interest is waning, and you want to inject humour into it as often as you can.
I feel since, you know, you are outlets for second-hand clothing, it's only appropriate that I do a few second-hand gags tonight. A man goes to the doctor, he says, I can't say my THs or Fs. The doctor says, well, you can't say fairer than that then.
You need to select your speaker with some care, because if people don't have a good evening and don't enjoy the speech, believe me, they'll never come again.
Prepare and prepare and prepare, so they don't go in and give a stock speech.
You have to take your time, you have to look them in the eye, you have to try to do less material, not more. The whole thing has to be a roller coaster, there has to be a shape to it, it has to come to an elegiac finish.
The ability to ad lib, which is terribly important, because if you're dying a death, you've got to have a way out of it.
I think quite often it's a toss-up between a speaker or a stripper, and perhaps they have a vote on it in committee and the stripper loses. I sometimes feel they would have been better off with one.
Anne Widdecombe, Sir Ranulph Fiennes and Giles Brandreth, among others there, on what makes a good after-dinner speech. It is said that a good speech should resemble a woman's skirt, long enough to cover the subject, but short enough to keep the interest. Not that I'd use that old line myself, everyone knows it. There is a kind of art to the after-dinner speech, and those who have not mastered it are guilty of inflicting terrible boredom and misery wherever they go. Here is businessman John Banham on Desert Island Discs in 1991 giving a very good reason for escaping to his island.
I would remember some of the appalling after-dinner speeches that I've had to listen to, and even more appalling after-dinner speeches I've had to give, and enjoy not having ever again to appear as an after-dinner entertainment for anybody.
And if this lot's anything to go by, I'll be packing my trunks and joining him on the island.
And coming here today to talk about government regulation and the motor industry, I hope to demonstrate that we are on your side.
Your Royal Highness, the Princess of Wales, the world will rejoice to know that I've lost my voice.
Here is Mr. Elliot M. Estes, who will talk with us today on the subject, a year of crucial decisions.
I've always maintained that I fly the flag, or we, the group, fly the flag for the Lancashire dialect, because we reckon that Lancashire is the best county in the world, and we always like to tell everybody. And when they changed it to Greater Manchester, that really peeved me.
I often had strange things happening to me because women reporters were comparatively unknown in those days.
And I would like to thank Players and our other sponsors who make it all possible to run a racing team, make it possible for men to really enjoy what they're doing.
How do you best present yourself after everyone has eaten? We've been looking through the archive to find some of the best and worst after-dinner speeches ever made. So, grab a glass of port, ladies and gentlemen, and let us begin, appropriately, with the world's first recording of an after-dinner speech.
Dear Mr. Hicks, his first friend, Edmund Hicks,
has been a little incoherent. It is in consequence of the excellent dinner and good wine which he has drunk. Therefore, I beg you would excuse him. He has his lucid intervals. For myself, I can only say that I am astonished and somewhat terrified.
That speech was recorded on yellow paraffin cylinders at the Little Menlo Club in 1888, where Arthur Sullivan was one of a number of guests recording messages for Thomas Edison in praise of his new invention, the phonograph. I bet Mr. Sullivan went down pretty well. Mind you, it was an easy crowd, small, cosy and half-cut. Things have changed since then. After-dinner speaking has become big business. Here's Barbara Kelly, who supplies speakers, talking costs to Melvyn Bragg in 1988.
It can be 500. I'm happier with 650. I know that I can deliver unto them what needs somebody that I will be happy with at 650, plus expenses, plus VAT. Now, that's for me, for my company, really, the starting point. And then it can go up to thousands, Melvyn. It really can go up to, oh, gosh, $5,000. But America, of course, I mean, over here, it's many, many, many money. In America, where it's really big business, I mean, it can be, you know, tens of thousands.
James Paul co-manages one of Britain's longest established after-dinner speaking agencies, and he has seen the business's rapid expansion.
Well, fees range quite considerably, but in the main, they tend to range from about £1,000, and the sky really is the limit. If you wanted to engage a former US president, you're into hundreds and hundreds of thousands. But in the main, I would say the average spend is anywhere between about £3,000 and £10,000, and that is going to give you a fantastic speaker and a great name.
It does undoubtedly help if you have been the President of the United States. My own ambitions are less lofty. It's a warm summer's evening, and I'm on the leafy campus of Keele University. In about 40 minutes, I'm going to just go up a little road and into a rather grand old hall called Keele Hall, where I am going to be the after-dinner speaker for the Charity Retail Association. Appropriately, I am wearing clothes purchased today in charity shops in Balham, where I live, so I'm quite pleased with that gag. I have been a little haphazard in my preparations, scouting around in the bushes here making notes.
Good evening.
I'm just hoping that my audience is going to be sufficiently well-oiled not to notice.
I hope you're all fed and watered.
And without further ado, let me introduce you a gentleman. His name is Arthur Smith, comedian and grumpy old man himself, host of BBC Radio 4's Arthur Smith, Balham Bash. Over to Arthur.
Anyway, I'm guessing some of you may know who I am, although I have had people turn up to shows I've done expecting to see Aerosmith.
After dinner speaking, by definition, is after people had a few drinks. You've got to kind of build that rapport very early on, in the first minute, for they know you're going to make them laugh.
It has to be fun and interesting, not too long, probably not too serious.
Entertaining and knowing how your audience is responding, and if it's not responding, then shut up and get off.
I think the real no-nos are rude jokes, anything sexist, racist. Religion is always difficult, and steer clear of insulting your audience.
Women are much better at engaging their audience. It's absolutely true. I'm sorry, I know Arthur's not a woman, and I bet he wishes he was.
So, based on my audience suggestions, no rude jokes, no swearing, keep it short, and be female. This is what I did.
Some of you may know me, perhaps, from Radio 4. May I say, to those of you who do not listen to Radio 4, in the end, you will. Some of you may know me from a TV show I did recently, Celebrity Dogging. I don't know if you saw it. There was me, Stan Collymore, some bloke from EastEnders, hanging around in a car park on the outskirts of Dudley. And every now and again, one of us would get in the back of a car and have sex with a woman with a bag over her head who turned out to be Esther Ranson. Anyway, I think it's a long night. I have to say, I think this is really, you are a splendid bunch of people, and well done for everything you do. Thank you.
I passed muster, but it wasn't great. Could do better. So I'm going to listen to some archive and to speak to some of the people who work in this world, linguists, coaches and wordsmiths. I need to revisit the drawing board. Where and when did all this rhetoric begin, for example?
I think that if we're looking for the origins of after-dinner speaking...
I spoke to historian Howell Williams.
It makes sense to look at the democratic life of Athens in the 5th century BC. Public speaking in the ancient world was something that was reserved for a certain elite who had been educated in a certain way. These were all-male occasions, no more than about 9 members to begin with. And you would meet in the home of the host, and there was a lot of drinking involved. Now, the informality of the setting does not exclude the possibility of an after-dinner speaker making really serious points in the middle of all the jokes.
Men like Marcus Tullius Cicero, for example.
In truth, if my country, which is far dearer to me than my life, if all Italy, if the whole republic were to address me, Marcus Tullius, what are you doing? Will you permit that man to depart, whom you have ascertained to be an enemy, whom you know to be expected in the camp of the enemy as their chief, the author of all this wickedness, the head of the conspiracy, the instigator of the slaves and abandoned citizens, so that he shall seem not driven out of the city by you, but let loose by you against the city?
Cicero's attacks on Mark Antony made him an enemy of the state, and he was murdered in 43 BC. That really is going down badly. So, maybe it's not such a good idea to use the after-dinner forum to publicly damn your enemies and talk politics. Or is it? Howell Williams again.
Now, from the late 17th century onwards, public debate is more directly political or recognisable in our terms. That's the time when after-dinner speeches become very important, still within the ambit of the elite. If we look, for example, at what happened in the Carlton Club, an important club for the Conservative Party, at the end of 1922, a number of important Conservative members of Parliament objected to Lloyd George as a personality, as a schemer, as an international Machiavellian and a very disturbing figure. And these guys, under really the effective leadership of Stanley Baldwin, met towards the end of 1922, and they met at the Carlton Club, and they made a public declaration afterwards. They would no longer support Lloyd George, and that was the end of Lloyd George as Prime Minister, and it was the return to office later on that year of a exclusively Conservative government.
On certain occasions, the after-dinner speech becomes an opportunity to say something serious or political. In 1952, US President Harold Truman used this after-dinner speech to implore people to support the war in Korea.
When we sit here tonight, in our evening clothes, bear in mind that there are men fighting and dying in an endeavor to reach that peace for which we've been striving since World War ceased. In order to accomplish that purpose, you must quit your bickering here at home. You must quit playing petty politics. You must remember that there are certain things that have to be done here at home if we're going to accomplish this purpose in the world. We're fighting for time. The young men in Korea and Japan are fighting for time for us. There's always an emphasis on the casualties in Korea. Of course, when there's fighting, there are casualties. But did it ever occur to you that if this necessity with which we are faced is not met, that the casualties in Korea will be one small drop in a bucket? One of those horrible bombs of which we talk so much. Think what a responsibility your president faces in a situation of this kind. If you'd think and think clearly on this subject, you'd get behind him and help him to win this peace, and that's what I'm asking you to do, and that's what our armed services in Korea want you to do.
Truman's passion and emotion won over his audience, at least. Although the war ended in stalemate, Congress called for his impeachment and he lost the next election. Still, he went down well on the night. Unlike Nikita Khrushchev, who badly misjudged the mood at a 1955 after-dinner speech in Bombay.
The Times, November the 26th, 1955. Mr. Khrushchev was the main offender, inflicting a 50-minute political diatribe on an audience waiting to enjoy a cultural programme. His long speech, for which he apologised, was an ill-timed review of the Cold War. Mr. Khrushchev said in his apology that speakers are like drunkards and they do not know how long they are talking.
Maybe Khrushchev could have done with some pointers from these self-help books I've come across. If only he'd opened his palms but kept his fingers down so as to be friendly yet unthreatening. I'm sure he would have got away with it then. Maintain eye contact for 84% of the presentation. Exaggerate each gesture by a quarter. Well, this one is indisputable. Your first line is the most important.
An after-dinner speaking is a great art. It is a tremendous art, and I confess that I have somewhat of a unique reputation in that field. Not for speaking, for eating. You know.
My lord.
And who would you choose if you're going to an area where for 4,000 miles there isn't a hospital or anything? Each person obviously must be able to take out the appendix of the rest. They must be able to take carburettors to bits at minus 60 wearing mitts. They need to map read without maps. In Antarctica, we obviously had a map, but it was all white. And
some corking lines there. It's all to do with words in the right order. I asked Dr. Ylva Berglund-Pritz from Oxford University how she might address a bunch of her fellow linguisticians.
I would probably try to think of an idea first, something that the audience could relate to. So if it's a linguistic audience, I might say, OK, is there a language joke or pun? Maybe there's some recent research. Maybe I open the newspaper and see, is there anything there that I can use as a starting point so that I have a shared basis with the audience and that I could build on?
What about one where it's going badly, where someone's attempted these things but not pulled them off? Then how would the language begin to change?
I would expect that the speaker would start stuttering or perhaps changing the way he or she is talking, perhaps possibly speak slower, but I would imagine if you get nervous, you will increase the speed and try to get more words in there, try to get the audience back.
Which, of course, I know from experience can be a dangerous game, and you're just gabbling.
But it's a dialogue, isn't it? Even if you're giving a speech, it's a dialogue in that you have an audience and you're there and you're dependent on their interaction as well. And if you do something to upset them or distance them from you, you don't have that dialogue anymore. You have opposition rather than collaboration.
My next interviewee, whom I sometimes think of as Derek Nimmo by other means, is a long-standing and prolific public speaker. Here he is in full flow, talking about his time in government.
The last cheque I signed was for £136 billion. Social Security payments first quarter. And I was told that with these huge cheques, your co-signatory, because with these big cheques you require a co-signatory, will be the head of the Treasury. And I thought, that's exciting. The Prime Minister, this is no. The Prime Minister is the first Lord of the Treasury. The head of the Treasury is Her Majesty, it's HM Treasury. You will be signing these cheques with the Queen. And so it came to pass that I signed these huge cheques with the Queen. And the first time I did this, I went along to Buckingham Palace, and it was a fairly nerve-wracking experience. I wasn't quite sure which of us, for a start, should sign first, because Brandreth comes quite a bit before either Elizabeth or Windsor. And I didn't want to patronise her, you know, political correctness being what it is, by saying after you. She had the pen and she seemed to think she should sign first, so I let her. I said to her, Your Majesty, I can't help wondering, you know, the government insists on the both of us signing all these huge cheques. I can't help wondering, Your Majesty, which of the two of us it is the government doesn't entirely trust.
Giles Brandreth is sat next to me on a dinner table, oddly enough,
Giles, you must have done a fair few dinner speeches in your time.
I've done thousands. I've been a professional after-dinner speaker for more than 40 years. And when I began, I was just down from Oxford University, where I'd been president of the union, that the union was a kind of sort of training ground for public speakers.
Yes. What were your speeches made up of in those early days? Well, you hadn't really done much.
I'd done absolutely bugger all. I mean, it was extraordinary, but I did not lack boldness. During my gap year, I'd visited America and I'd visited the Soviet Union. So I did a talk entitled Giles Brandreth, America and Russia, an entertaining romp around two great nations.
Yeah.
And in 40 minutes flat, I think the emphasis on the flat, I would cover my trips to America and Russia. I mean, you have to hope that they will like you at the end of it.
Mm.
And they will only like you if you genuinely like them. And I try to make it a memorable occasion. I can't always. Last Friday, I was giving a speech somewhere, and I asked the man, I said, who did you have last year? He said, oh, I can't remember. He was good enough. He was fine, actually. It was me. But he just didn't remember.
Well, it's better than he was terrible. Yeah. So what do you think the key elements of a good after-dinner speech are?
I mean, the rules are you have to be topical and you have to be relevant to the audience. You have to be concise. You have to be good-humoured, good-hearted. I would never use bad language. I try never to speak after 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah. Well, how long do you think it should be?
The ideal length, to be honest, is, I think, really, actually, probably 10 and 20 minutes as a perfect, you know.
Yeah. Now, I believe, Giles, you have the world record longest after-dinner speech. Tell us about this.
12 and a half hours. I got up to speak at 9:15 when they were clearing away dinner, and I sat down at 9:30 in the morning as they were clearing away breakfast. And I did it in aid of the National Playing Field Association. It was a charity gig. And I first did it as a charity challenge and spoke for about 3.5 hours. That was, you know, I broke a Victorian record, spoke for 3.5 hours. And in the audience was Nicholas Parsons. And I didn't realise then that Nicholas is one of the most competitive human beings on the planet. He couldn't stand the idea that he, also on the after-dinner circuit, was being bested by this scrap of a lad. So he then spoke for 7 hours. So I then spoke for 9 hours. He then came back into the fray. And then the charity said to us, this is absurd, you two. Let's get you together and do it on the same night. So at the Hyde Park Hotel in adjacent rooms, Nicholas Parsons and I got up and it was one of the most exhausting nights of either of our lives because we could hear the laughter from the adjacent room. So Nicholas would get a laugh, I'd then have to get a bigger one. He'd then go into his
seat. Yeah, so many big laughs you can get after we go for 7 hours.
The real challenge was 3 a.m, needing to go to the loo. What do
you weren't allowed a loo break?
No.
What, 12 hours without a wee?
12 and a half hours without a wee, yes.
12 and a half hours? Is he human? Anyway, unless you're going for a new world record, keep it short and be sincere. Anne Widdecombe is one of the leading female speakers on the after-dinner circuit.
I suppose I'm doing about 2 or 3 after-dinner speeches a week. I think after-dinner speeches have to be dignified affairs. It's no good doing what I know some after-dinner speakers do and just deliver a whole load of risque jokes to a mixed audience. I mean, it's not quite what people expect. And the other thing you must never do is deliver an after-dinner speech that's devoid of humour or that goes on too long or that is addressed principally to the water carafe instead of to the audience or indeed that is inflexible. I think part of the skill of after-dinner speaking is that you're noting the audience's reactions as you go along and you're tailoring the speech as you go along to fit in with those reactions. It's meant to be entertaining. It's not meant to be confrontational. It's not meant to be Ciceronian rhetoric. It's meant to be digestible. They've just had a huge meal. They don't want an indigestible speech.
But when it comes to after-dinner patter, the running order is everything.
You go to some places where they will have 5 speakers. There's, ooh, you know, yeah, the managing director, idea. The chief executive, the chairman,
yeah,
the Lord
worse.
Mayor,
yeah.
The high sheriff, and then you're on.
Mind you, I do find that if you've got someone from the company doing a 3 or 4 minutes and they're not very good, ideal.
Oh, I love that. I love it. When they're not, they've got to be good enough for it not to become chaos.
Yeah.
A bit dull, they've just about held it, they've got no microphone technique.
Yeah.
That's exactly what you want.
Yeah.
Then you get
you
up.
You shine like
and whatever you like, you seem to be good.
But what if the speakers you were following happened to be Tommy Cooper, Jimmy Tarbuck and Arthur Askey? Even the seasoned comic can fall flat then. And sure enough, here is one, Ernie Wise, in the 1978 tribute dinner to Max Bygraves.
I know his fan club's here today, but I don't know where he sat. He's the only man I know who can sing while brushing his teeth. I remember him when he first started in show business. He'd been a star for, oh, I don't know, 30 years. He gave me some advice. He said, son, show business is not all sex and sin. You have to have an act as well. And that's what it's all about. Max has got a good act, family entertainment, a credit to our business, and always a clean comedian, a sort of Cockney Bernard Manning.
And Sir Ranulph Fiennes knows the pitfalls of following a big name. Here he is recalling a speech he made in the 1980s.
I was asked to do the Oil Baron's Ball one year. That's 2,000 people in the Grosvenor House. And I had to speak for the oil industry after the guest speaker had spoken, because at that time I was working for Occidental Oil. So I asked the organisers who the guest speaker was so that I could prepare something to say about him or her. And they wouldn't tell me. They said, security, we'll tell you 2 hours before the speaker comes. And it turned out to be Mrs. Thatcher 5 days after the Brighton bomb. If you thought she was popular during the Falklands War, which she was even more popular after she'd nearly been blown up in Brighton. So she spoke, and I was sitting next to her. I could see her notes, and she wasn't sticking to the notes. She was extemporising brilliantly and very witty. And they, the 2,000 of them, they loved it. They stamped. At the end of it, she sort of looked down at me and she said, I'm sorry, I can't listen to the next speaker's speech because I've got to go back to the house. And she left the Grosvenor, and 2,000 of them stamped and clapped for 5 minutes after she'd left the room. And if I could have disappeared under the table, I would have done.
At a 1983 celebration of the Year of the Castle, Prince Charles was the star speaker after comedian Max Boyce.
Your Royal Highnesses, my Lord Parry, Abraham Lincoln. This is a great night. The inaugural dinner to launch the Year of the Castle. The sort of function where you can go home afterwards and be proud to say. And be proud to say that I was there.
If ever there was a case of throwing down the gauntlet, Boyce is energetic, lyrical, and has the audience in the palm of his hand. All but one. It's at this point that Prince Charles starts ignoring Max Boyce's speech and starts scribbling on his own note cards in response to this dynamic delivery. And surely that's good. He's not going to stick to his script. He's adapting what he had planned. But Max Boyce hasn't quite finished.
I went to London last week, me and my pal Billy Williams, to go and see what to wear. So we're going down New Bond Street. It's a true story, this, isn't it? We're going down New Bond Street, right, and all the expensive clothes shops, Herbie, Frogs, Lord John, Cecil G. And we pass... and we passed this shop, and Billy Williams looked. He said, look at it. He said, look at them shoes in that shop. He said, look at the price of them shoes. £200, he said. He said, they haven't even got laces. He said, why are they so expensive? I said, they're crocodile shoes. He said, that's why they're so expensive. They're crocodile shoes. He said, you, if I could have a pair of them, he said, I could come to a dinner in Caerphilly Castle with you, he said. I said, well, you can't. I said, you can't afford them anyway. I said, you're one of the 3 million unemployed. You're one of Maggie's army, I said. You can't afford a pair of them shoes. He was in his mind all day. He couldn't think of anything. Then he said, I've got it, he said. I know where I can get a pair of them shoes. He said, when we go back, he said, we'll go to Longleat. He said, they've got monkeys there, giraffes. He said, they're bound to have crocodiles. I said, they have. He said, will you come with me? Oh, I said, oh, all right. So we went to Longleat and we waited. All the tourists were there. And we waited for the great iron doors at Longleat to clang shut. And one by one, the lights went out at Longleat. He said, you ready? I said, right. And he came all prepared. He had this big box. And he had all these little tins of cherry blossom boot polish. He blacked all our faces up and the backs of our hands. Like, yes, yes. And then he put, like, stockings over our heads. Mind you, we messed that up a bit. Because he fetched tights. And wherever he went, I went. So, down the river we sailed. Came to this clearing in the river, and then we came to this fork in the river, so we split up. We'd only gone about 20 minutes downstream, and we were screaming. So I put the raft in reverse and back up the stream. And there he was in this clearing, amongst all these rushes. And there he was screaming, and his shirt was torn off his chest, and he was covered in blood. And there on the bank were seven dead crocodiles on top of each other. And he had one under his arm, a great 95-footer. And he was stomping in the snout with a big iron pipe. And he said, shut up. I said, shut up, you'll wake everybody else. Oh, Max, said, I'm fed up. He said, this is the 10th one I've caught now. He said, and none of them got shoes on. He said.
The time is coming for Prince Charles. He's looking confident and taking inspiration from Max Boyce. He needs a lofty opening line and a personal story.
I really don't think I can follow that at all. And in fact, I've never felt less like making a speech in my life. But no doubt you all envy me very much the task that I have now, which is to try and follow this superb Welshman here, who tells a story like only Welshmen can. And I don't even claim to be able to tell stories like he can, or most other Welshmen can. Ladies and gentlemen, you may wonder what life in a castle is like. I have spent a certain part of my life in one castle or other, and I'm informed reliably that this particular castle, Caerphilly, is the second biggest in the country, if not in Europe, after Windsor Castle. Now, I would dearly love to explore this particular edifice as I did Windsor Castle when I was a child. They can be enormously enjoyable when you are at a reasonably young age. And I shudder to think now what my sister and I got up to when exploring Windsor. We used to crawl all over the place, all round the battlements and the roofs, and out onto where all the fire escapes were. And half the time, nobody knew where the hell we were, fortunately. But it did provide the most marvellous introduction to the sort of life that people might have led a very long time ago, particularly from the point of view of various places at Windsor, which went back a very long way indeed. There's one particular turret or tower which had still some stocks that remained at the bottom of it, and secret passages, and various steps which were designed for priests to escape from their persecutors at various points in history. And they were so steep that they were specially designed that one of them was much wider than all the others, so that if you knew the steps, you were all right. But if you didn't, and the priest was escaping and he knew it, and the chap following didn't know it, then you took one step down the big step, and that was that, and you hoped you made a quick getaway. But all this helped to give me, at least, a sense of history, which I think is extremely important in understanding so many different aspects of life.
For once, Prince Charles has been disadvantaged by birth. He told a personal story and linked it to the event he was at, but unfortunately, growing up in a castle is never going to be as funny as breaking into Longleat and skinning a crocodile. So another rule of the after-dinner circuit, unless you're following someone really dull, try and get in there first with a killer speech. But Tommy Cooper was the type of speaker who didn't really need to follow rules.
Hello. It was funny, I tell you that. I don't know, it was pretty funny. Ladies and gentlemen, the maitre d', head waiter, the chef, the doorman, and his wife. As a matter of fact, I had a little bit of trouble getting here today. I got a little slight impediment in my back. I couldn't get it off the bed. So when I got here, well, the committee said to me, you know it's Max's 30th year anniversary, I said, yes. They said, well, would you like to make a speech? I said, certainly. I said, on what subject? They said, no. I'll put that one in the extra note. Nothing to do with it, really. They said, no, we want you to tell everybody what a nice man he is, what a great performer, lovely personality. I said, what do you think I am, a magician?
Well, make some thank yous and pull some funny faces, although not many of us are as good at that as Tommy Cooper. Mind you, Arthur Askey managed to follow him.
May I say at the outset, I appear here today by arrangement with the National Trust. Now, I'm going to start reading you from my biography. Now in paperback. I can't read it all. It's bloody good, but I haven't got time. But this is what it says on page one. What they said at the Variety Club tribute lunch to mark Arthur Askey's 50 years in show business. And then it's a lot of quotes from nice people who said nice things about me, including Morecambe and Wise. What's happened to them? Won't you leave the BBC? And then there's Tarby, Jimmy Tarbuck, the well-known golfer, Harry Secombe. But then Max. Now, this is what Max said about me at my do. He said, I remember Arthur went through a quiet time about 4 years ago. We all do. He went for an audition for the leading part in O Calcutta, but lost it by half an inch.
Well, in the 70s, you could get away with a dash of smut and a dollop of gentle ribbing. But the common denominator with that roll call of who's who in 70s variety? Funny. It has to be funny. And the barometer of what's funny? The audience, of course. Because what's funny for one audience won't necessarily cut it for another. Take this speech. It was runner-up at the Idaho State After Dinner Speech Competition a few years ago.
We're trying to tell you other Hindus how it is like to be a Hindu living in America. We talk about some of the problems Hindus face, and also how to be a good member of American society. So let's get started. First, let's talk about traveling. How do you get to America? Okay, ever since that stupid Osama bin Laden did his thing, yeah, people who look like this are having a hard time getting on an airplane. I mean, the terrorists weren't Muslim, were Hindus. But you know, Muslims look like Hindus. Oh look, a metal detector. Let me go through it. Oh look, it didn't beep. Ah, sir, can you please step to the side? Okay. Is there a problem? No problem. You've just been randomly selected. So, where are you headed? Oh, well, I'm going to Disneyland. Everybody wants to go to Disneyland. Don't you want to go to Disneyland? No. In fact, I've been there once. It sucks. Oh, well, I heard it is the bomb.
Peppered with topical references and relevant bon mot, the speech went down well in front of his fellow Hindis. It may not have gone down quite as well, of course, in front of a room full of airport security operatives. You have to know your audience, just like professional speaker John Bell.
A doctor said to me, how is your mum and dad? Still dead.
Good, good.
To my doctor, dead.
Yes, yes. Dead, right. What did your father do then just before he died? He went all pale and fell off his stool.
A speech totally appropriate to his audience of healthcare professionals. And what might one do for the Hertfordshire Caterers Federation dinner? This speech from 1963 comes from the Hertfordshire Archives.
Nice to ask FJO to be guest speaker, but no qualifications. Used to be allowed to boil eggs, but once forgot timing. Boiled dry. Eggs volatilised and coated inside of saucepan with glossy black enamel. Irremovable. Since then, only allowed to wash dishes. Expert.
Here's Will Rogers nominating Henry Ford for president in 1923. A speech crammed with driving puns.
The Democrats are the middle of the road party. The Republicans are the straddle of the road party. So I hereby nominate Mr. Henry Ford for president and christen the party the All Over the Road Party. He has made more money than any man in the world by paying the highest wages.
But there are some speeches that'll only ever work for one select audience. And this speech from the Churchill Archives, delivered to the Cambridge 41 Club in 1996, no doubt struggled to amuse even molecular biologists.
when an animal is infected with a bacteria, virus, or otherwise injected with a foreign substance, the animal who has never seen the bacteria, the virus, or the foreign substance learns to recognise that this is a foreign substance. At the time, we had no idea how this could be achieved. It was a fascinating question. It was during the early stages of this quest, when we were beginning to scratch the surface of the problem, that we discovered a way of making monoclonal antibodies at will. It is not easy to explain what monoclonal antibodies are all about without sending you or half of you to sleep. Do not worry, you can always blame it on the wine.
But what do you do if things are going badly? Can you ever recover from a downward spiral? I suppose you could always fall back on sentiment. Advice duly noted by MP Jeremy Thorpe at a celebratory dinner for Dame Vera Lynn in 1975.
I suppose that when the great film of the war is made and the Blitz is brought in, everyone would agree that it would not be complete without Vera and her singing. And the fact that she did something in the war which very few other people had it in their power to do. She visited the front line and she brought back something of the brightness and the happiness of the days of peace, which people were able to recall. And what she did to uplift the spirit of those who were fighting in the front line, I believe was incalculable. And the honor that is bestowed on her is one of the most deferred post-war credits that has yet been paid out by a grateful nation. And so, all I want to say is this, Vera, you really are quite a dame, not only in the sense that a grateful nation formalized in the last honors list, but in the affection of the people of this country. We'll certainly meet again. Your song may be yours, but as far as we are concerned, you are ours. We salute you, we congratulate you, we say God bless, and thank you for what you have meant to every one of us.
But there's sentimental and there's sentimental. I, for one, think you should draw the line at singing. Advice Pat Boone ignored at a Conservative political action conference in 1996.
And so I felt that we needed a musical lesson, a history lesson, and that was something I could do. I could write and record a song, which I did. And I put it in an album called American Glory, which, sad to say, is the only album recorded of our American patriotic songs and military anthems in 50 years. Nobody's done it. P. Diddy didn't think of it. Snoop Dogg didn't get around to it. Eminem, it's skipped his thought process. He couldn't rap to them. And so I recorded those songs, did a video. And then I added this song, which went to 15 in the Billboard Hot 100 single chart, to my amazement, which means that most Americans still do resonate to these two words. And I would like to sing you this musical history lesson from American Glory with those two politically incorrect words, under God. Just three tiny wooden vessels sail the vast uncharted seas. On the beach, the weary pilgrims dropped exhausted to their knees. Oh, our God, they cried, you've saved us by your mighty outstretched hand. And we dedicate our lives here in this new and wondrous land. Under God, under God, how can we exist apart from God?
Now, Mr. Boone made quite a few errors in that speech, I think. It was full of self-promotion. He tried to be down with the kids. Note the reference to Eminem. He sang, and he brought religion into it. And according to my books and experts, religion is nearly as bad as racism for after-dinner disasters. For comedic illustrative purposes only, here's a clip from Little Britain set at a policeman's ball.
In Ham Ham, ex-Olympic athlete Denver Mills has been booked to give an after-dinner speech.
A little bit of hush, ladies and gentlemen. That includes you, Detective Inspector Willow. Okay, it is time to introduce you to our special guest speaker of the evening, You may have seen him on They Think It's All Over. Please give it up for Olympic silver medalist Denver Mills.
Evening all.
It's great to be here. You know, when I was a lad, I always dreamed of going into the force. But maybe being an Olympic athlete isn't so different from being a police officer. First of all, we both get a lot of practice running after black guys. Difference is, I beat some of mine. I mean, caught up with them, not beat them like you do.
But what are other faux pas? Well, for example, jokes about the royal family and colostomy bags may be acceptable in some late-night comedy club, but not at a formal dinner, as Trevor Phillips found out in 1997.
The Evening Standard. The quip, made on the Queen's birthday, went down like a lead balloon as hundreds of guests reacted with gasps of horror. One appalled guest said Mr. Phillips left the entire audience in disgust. In a statement, a spokesman said the comments were not meant to cause offence.
With the after-dinner speech no longer a closed forum, a degree of political correctness is de rigueur for the modern speaker. I asked Mr. Brandreth if he'd ever regretted something almost as he was saying it.
Yes, I have, and I'm now much more careful about political correctness than I used to be. You've got to remember, if you're a professional after-dinner speaker, that you're there as the servant of the people who've employed you. And actually, I now think it's better to have a happy and successful occasion than a riotous one where some people have been upset.
Which means it's highly unlikely Alfred Marx could get away with this 70s classic today. Apologies in advance to our Irish listeners.
My bête noire, the thing I can't stand, are after-dinner speakers who just come up and stand up and tell jokes. Nothing at all to do with the subject in hand, just jokes with some sort of obvious, tenuous attachment to the subject they're talking about. This is cheating. I don't believe in that. Somebody might say, speaking of Vera Lynn's damehood reminds me of the man who went up to another man and said, have you heard the story about the Irishman? And the second man said, I think I should tell you I am Irish. And the first man said, all right, I'll tell it to you slowly. You see, it has nothing at all to do with what's in hand, and I certainly wouldn't be guilty of doing that.
Geographical location is also a barometer of taste when it comes to after-dinner engagements. Gordon and James Poole again.
Some people are not suitable for some jobs, and that's it in a nutshell, really.
I mean, if you wanted to book Jethro for maybe an event in Yorkshire, I don't think the audience are really going to understand what he's on about. But the only times when region comes into play is maybe when they're having a sporting speaker. And, you know, I don't think I'd be too comfortable supplying maybe a former Welsh rugby legend to an English rugby club dinner or vice versa.
But it seems former Scottish rugby player Gavin Hastings was more than up for that challenge, here being interviewed in 1995.
Now, I know that you do a lot of after-dinner speaking. I've heard you speak, and you do tend to wind the English up, don't you?
I don't know where you get that from, Don.
Oh,
but,
come on.
No, there's always some good-natured banter that goes on, and when you've heard me speak, I think it's always been, if you like, in enemy territory down in England, and I'm probably a bit worse when I'm up in home territory as well. But no, it's all in good-natured fun, and there's nothing wrong, I think, than taking a harmful dig at the English. They've certainly done it to us often enough in the field.
Hang on, didn't he just say harmful dig at the English?
There's nothing wrong, I think, than taking a harmful dig at the English.
Yes, he did. Freudian slip, eh? Now, as it is for midwives, so it is for after-dinner speakers. Delivery is everything. Hand in hand with the rise of after-dinner speaking has been the rise and rise of the professional speaking coach, and they've come a long way since this example from 1988.
Now, the voice is the musical instrument of the human body. It possesses enormous potential for flexibility to be an interesting auditory experience. And yet so many presentations are delivered in a dull, rather monotonous voice that sometimes sets one's teeth on edge with no light and shade whatsoever.
Oh yes, don't speak in a monotone. What a brilliant idea, that hadn't occurred to me. But what difference can a voice coach actually make? Mark Lemesma is a current public speaking coach, and I asked him what that entails.
It entails helping people find their voice. A lot of people are really held back by a fear of public speaking.
Yes.
Oddly enough, it's not a fear that is natural. However, many, many people are required to speak for business, for pleasure. And that fear of speaking really holds them back and it stops them achieving what they want to do.
Where does it come from, that fear, do you think?
I think it's a social fear. It's a fear of looking inadequate in front of one's peers.
Robert Murray Willis was your classic glossophobe until he met Mark.
I felt as if an express train was on its way and I was attached to the rails.
So you kind of dreaded doing them?
Yes, and so I'd write things down and I'd try and rehearse and learn.
And did they not go well in these early days?
I found that the words became jumbled. I wasn't connecting to the audience. And sometimes the point was being missed.
And how many sessions did it take with Mark before you felt you'd made the necessary improvement?
Certainly after two, and each session I've had with Mark has just built that level of confidence.
Mark is going to show us an exercise, which you could do at home, and both Robert and myself can do here, which is going to help you to become a better speaker, I believe.
Well, one of the most important things when one is lacking confidence as a speaker is to get control of your physiology. So I'd like to do a little breathing exercise with you that will help you calm down. So what I'd like you both to do for me is just to stand with your hands by your sides. Mm-hmm. Just take a nice deep breath all the way up from the balls right up to the top of the chest. Hold it for a heartbeat and then let it go suddenly. And just listen to the room. Can you feel it's a little quieter, a little bit more measured? We've done a forced sigh. Well, the sigh is the body's natural way of dumping all that tension.
Right, here we go. Right, are you ready, Robert? We're doing the sigh, you know, all right? The release, yeah, OK.
Words like violence break the silence. Come crashing in.
Ah, yes, oxygen, a must-have for speaking, as for life. One also needs some lubrication of the vocal cords.
Pray silence for Mr. Barry Cryer. Thank you. When I was solicited by the World Life Belt, Life Boy World Wife Finding Bun... Oh, dear. Sorry, when I was asked... Oh, sorry, I can't stop yawning. It's because I've had a drink. It does that to me. See, oh, dear me. I could just nod off. It's no good. I'm just going to have a little nap. Talk amongst yourselves. Thank you. Be wonderful. I've been Barry Cryer. Tell your friends.
Now, I know Barry likes a shandy or two before a speech, but that was actually a comedy sketch from the Count Arthur Strong Show here on Radio 4. But there is a fine line between being amiably tipsy and hopelessly drunk. But it's not just the speaker who needs to avoid the booze. Listen to these laments of a speaker and publisher from the 1980s.
There are some dinners where they really ought never to have had a speaker at all because they're all so happy with their own company and have consumed so much cheering fluid during the course of the evening that by the time the poor devil gets up to address them, they've completely lost interest in anything except where the next drink's going to come from.
Or the other terror is that your author is going to either make an appalling speech or get drunk or both. And I've been to one literary dinner where the speech was absolutely disastrous, and I was sitting by the author, who was completely drunk, and trying to nudge him and persuade him to stop, and eventually I passed him a note saying, I think you've gone over your time. But at the same time, I was trying to pretend that I had nothing whatsoever to do with him, that I was not the publisher. I've never seen this man ever before. But he picked up my note and read it, and then put his arm around my shoulder and said, this is my publisher here, and he says, I've got to stop speaking. What do you think? And the audience roared back, sit down. And so he just ended his speech then and there.
And sometimes some things happen during a speech that you just could not anticipate.
Well, I've had several at which people have died.
Well, that could be good if they were dying laughing.
Indeed, but it can be disconcerting.
It is true. If a member of your audience dies, it's not always good.
Well, particularly in a very crowded room, which did once happen to me in Bournemouth. This fellow died. He died.
Well, he just sort of sparked out, fell over.
He fell backwards, which is one of the key signs. He fell backwards. The eyes opened, rolled up. There he was, dead. And the speech was going really well. what did you do? So, in fact, I carried on while the people on either side of him took him out.
There's dedication to your art. Never stop, whatever happens. I've romped through some of the best and worst after-dinner speeches in history and found it's anything but a dying art. But here's one question. In 2,500 years of after-dinner speaking, who's the best?
The best speaker actually was Ronnie Corbett, who I didn't expect to be amazing.
People like Giles Brandreth, Barry Cryer, David Gunson, Gary Richardson.
Anne Widdecombe. Sir Ranulph Fiennes is a fine speaker.
Michael Portillo, and he was certainly very professional.
I think we had Robin Innes last year, and he was hilarious.
One of the best ones was McGaskill, the weatherman.
One of the very best is Geoffrey Archer. A certain element of shamelessness is perhaps necessary.
I think Willie Whitelaw used to make very, very amusing after-dinner speeches.
Tony Benn. Tony Benn is somebody who's got quite an affected voice, but whether you agree with his politics or not, he speaks with passion and conviction and a pace that makes people stop and listen to it.
Neil Kinnock.
The two best speakers, I think, undoubtedly, were Bill Clinton and Archbishop Tutu. The end of a Desmond Tutu speech, my gosh, you feel, a good time's been had by all. He warms the room. What more can you ask for in an after-dinner speech? A good time was had by all.
You never want to follow Archbishop Tutu.
You don't.
We interviewed 2,000 people for that last bit, but still not one of them mentioned my name. Ah, but now I've done this programme, this might all change, because here are Arthur Smith's top tips for how to do a perfect after-dinner speech.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Deliver a winning first line. Keep it short. Be the first of a series of good speakers or the last in a series of bad ones. Be adaptable and feel free to go off-piste. Know your audience and their mood. Be funny or sentimental or both. Don't sing, but do breathe. Don't get drunk, but be confident. And if all else fails, I hear Desmond Tutu's a bargain at 10 grand an hour. I'm Arthur Smith. Please raise your glasses. Good night.
Raise Your Glasses was presented by Arthur Smith and featured the voice of Brendan Charlson. The producer was Sean Price, and it was a Tinderbox production for BBC Radio 4.